I'm pleased to be able to introduce to you one of my good friends, Elder Earl Tingey, as the speaker this evening. I looked at his resume, and I am interested in the way in which the Lord's prepared him for the assignment that he now has as the executive director of the missionary committee of the church. He's the general authority that really manages the missionary department of the church, that's responsible for the supervision of missionaries all over the world, responsible for working with the Quorum of the Twelve in terms of all of the calls, and handles all the paperwork in those calls. He grew up in Utah. He was educated and received an attorney's degree or a law degree from the University of Utah, and then for almost 25 years lived in New York City, where he was an associate general counsel for a very large corporation. Then he was called to, when he was called to be a general authority, one of his first assignments was in Africa, where he was in the area presidency for the Africa area. It was in the days, just in this last year, we've split Africa into two parts. I don't know if you know how big Africa is. 3 years ago, I flew from Johannesburg to Frankfurt, Germany. Johannesburg on this, down in the southern part of Africa. It was about an 11.5-hour trip from Johannesburg to Frankfurt, and 9 hours, 9.5 hours was over the African continent. Until this year, three general authorities have had responsibility for all of Africa. And for a period of time, Elder Tingey was one of those brethren who traveled from country to country to country, working with governments and preparing those governments to receive missionaries, to approve missionaries coming into those countries, and then working with the missionaries and the members as we developed the missions there. So Elder Tingey's had an experience in Africa. He served as a mission president in Australia, so he's seen another part of the earth. And now as the executive director, he sees the whole missionary program across the entire earth, which is an interesting experience for him. I'm grateful for his willingness to be with us tonight. I know that he's received from you a number of questions, and he's going to address questions that will interest you in terms of missions. We're grateful to have with him tonight Sister Joanne Tingey, his wife. She's been by his side in Africa, in Australia, in New York, wherever he's been, and been a very strong companion. So I introduce to you Brother Elder Earl C. Tingey. Brother Tingey.
Thank you, President Bateman. It's really a marvelous experience to be here tonight and just feel of your spirit. As I sat here trying to just watch you and with these bright lights, you all kind of have a halo over your head. I hope that stays there. But I felt of the spirit of who you are. As I watched you stand up in groups, I was just almost overwhelmed with how many of you have served missions, how many plan to serve, how many of you have calls. I congratulate you. I know the Lord is pleased with who you are and what you're doing. I'm very appreciative for this lovely violin music that we've heard tonight. There's something about violin and piano together that just kind of melts me, and it just brings the spirit in a way that there's no other experience I can imagine than to have something as beautiful as that. I appreciate that very, very much. I appreciate the invitation from Brother Flake. I'm grateful to be here with my colleague, President Bateman. He and I serve side by side in the First Quorum and have a marvelous experience as we get together and see the work of the Lord as it goes forth throughout all the world. Now, I've done everything I could do to prepare for tonight except to prepare a talk. I trust in the Spirit, and I believe that if we have the Spirit here tonight, and I feel it, that we will be able to communicate in such a way that any talk I might have prepared would diminish in terms of what you would feel by the Spirit. Let me initially just give you a few brief facts, and then I'd like to respond, if I could, to some of your questions. I was most intrigued about your questions. It would be so nice if we could just sit in a little classroom and five or six of you and just one-on-one questions and answers. We had a little bit of that upstairs when I met with Brother Flake and some of our associates here on the stand. But since that would be impractical with a large group, I'll try to have the same experience by the written questions you have sent me. But let me just tell you a little bit about what's happening in the church generally. We are just now at 59,000 missionaries worldwide. This is the largest number of missionaries that have ever been serving at one time in the church, so far as we know, as far as the records that have been kept. 59,000 missionaries. That is an increase of almost 12,000 missionaries over the last 4 years. So it's a steady increase, growing every day. And for that, we're grateful for you and all of you who plan to serve a mission. We have 331 missions in the world. This year, there were 13 new missions created. And so the missions are virtually everywhere, except generally in the Islamic countries of the world and in mainland China. We do not have missionaries in those two general areas. But outside of that, we have missionaries in most countries, islands of the sea, and places like that. Elder President Bateman mentioned Africa, and I might say that President Bateman was one of the first of all those who went to Africa to begin the work before we were there. That's a story in and of itself. But of the 50 countries of Africa, we are basically established in about 25, where we have units, we have chapels, we have members, we have little branches, we have missionaries serving. And so you see the work is growing and it's spreading, and it's just marvelous. We have 15 MTCs. Now, if you might have thought that the MTC just down the road is the only one, that's our largest one. But we have 14 others, and they're scattered in key countries throughout the world where we teach the same instruction to those missionaries, only in their language, as we do here. Brother Ostergaard, one of the stake presidents here, is the director of the MTC. He does a marvelous assignment there, does a marvelous work. We teach in about 43 languages, and missionaries are located in about 135 countries, nations, and territories. So that gives you a little bit of the feel of the length and breadth of the church as far as its full-time missionaries are concerned. Now let me go quickly and read a couple of these questions, and I'll do my best to try and respond. Question number one, what is the most important thing a young man or woman can do to prepare for serving a mission? My feeling on this is really pretty simple. One thing I recommend you not do is don't feel that you have to learn the discussions before you go on a mission, or even learn the first discussion. Sometimes we find that that becomes a focus in some areas of the church, some stakes, say. And really, we can teach you those discussions at the MTC far better if you come simply prepared to be taught. So I wouldn't worry about that. But what I would do if I were at your age, I would try to strengthen your testimony of the gospel by reading the Book of Mormon. I think that's the most important thing you can do, is to gain a stronger testimony and witness of the Book of Mormon. Now, when I speak of the Book of Mormon, I'm not necessarily saying that you must know events and places and things. That's important. But what you ought to know are the doctrines of the gospel that are found in the Book of Mormon. And you can turn to them. Because when you leave the MTC and you arrive in São Paulo, Brazil, or Phnom Penh, Cambodia, where I was 2 weeks ago, you're going to be standing on a door or in a street, and suddenly all you will do is bear testimony. And that's when you need a testimony. And there may not be time to read right then. So use the time now to strengthen your testimony of the Book of Mormon. Some of the doctrines, I'll just use as an example, the doctrine of the atonement. Look in Alma 39 to 42, Alma 34. 2 Nephi 2, 2 Nephi 9, and other key chapters where most of the doctrines relating to the atonement are found. Look in Alma 36 and read of repentance. You won't find any better outline of the steps of repentance than in Alma 36. Alma 32, faith. You remember that wonderful story of the seed of faith. There's many, many sections of the Book of Mormon. Try to get a stronger testimony of the doctrines through reading of the book. Number two in preparation, I would say, is live worthily. Live worthily so that when you enter the mission field, you're willing and ready and worthy to serve. And I'll speak of that on another question. Keep your personal religious activity very high. What I mean by that is your personal prayers, your scripture reading, your family home evenings with your family if you're in a dormitory or if you're at home, your personal payment of tithes and offerings. Those are personal worship attributes. Observe all of those so that you go into the field fully prepared on that type of living of the gospel. And I would say keep your dress and grooming that which would approach a missionary. One of the saddest things we see, and Brother Ostergaard sees this from time to time, is when a missionary arrives at the MTC, but their grooming is such that we could not send them out in the field yet. Hair may have to grow out. Color may have to come out of hair. And all sorts of things like that. It would be a great disfavor for you to go into the full-time missionary service if you were not looking like a missionary. The other missionaries would notice that. You would feel ill-prepared. So begin to act and dress and think like a missionary. That'll be helpful as you purchase clothes, because the missionary has a dress standard which you'd want to rise up to. That would be a part of your preparation. And I think you would try to prepare yourself in little things like your ability to work, your ability to be dependable. When you're on a mission, certain times you get up in the morning, certain times you go down, you cook your own meals. All of those are attitudes of self-motivation. Try to be dependable in those kind of things. President Benson would say the best preparation for a mission is work, work, and work. Learn how to work. Learn how to be dependable. And then financial planning, you need to make sure that you have the finances to serve a mission. It's a wonderful thing if you have help from your family, but I'll tell you this, the mission won't mean as much to you as it would otherwise if you don't contribute to the mission. I had a letter shared with me when we were just on a trip to the Far East. It was in Bangkok, Thailand. The mission president said, I want to share this letter with you. And a missionary there wrote of how he sold his prize horse, which was his most prized possession, in order to go on a mission. Learn a little sacrifice. Save a little money that you can spend on your mission. Don't depend entirely on your parents. If we receive an application to serve a mission and there is no contribution from the family or the missionary, the brethren will return it to the stake, because we cannot have you serving without contributing. Otherwise, you are a paid minister, and we have no paid ministers among the ranks of missionaries. We want you to contribute to your mission. Question number two. If someone goes on a mission unworthily and is sent home, can he return to the mission field? If so, how long must he wait? These things are governed by the First Presidency, and they have issued several letters. The most recent was in June of this year. Your bishop and stake president will have copies of these letters, and I would suggest you sit down with them if you have a key question in this area, and they will read the letter to you. They will share it to you. But the essence is this. There are certain types of activities, which we call serious transgression, that if they are committed by a person, then that person is not eligible to be a missionary. And it will take a minimum of 1 year from when that occurred before you would be eligible to serve. Now, if you're not certain what that type of activity is, and I know you all are, but if you think you're not, then you can sit down with your bishop and your stake president, and they'll explain it to you. It's so important that you enter the mission field completely prepared. I often use the illustration of a man who is walking down a country street. He has on his back a bag, a burlap bag, or a gunny sack, we used to call them. As he walks along, he picks up little rocks and stones in the road, trying to clean up the roadway. After some period of time, after several days of walking, he has half a bag, and pretty soon three-quarters of a bag. Pretty soon he has a whole bag of rocks on his shoulder. His walking is slower, and he no longer has the strength to carry that. He must either stop and not reach his destination, or he must provide for some means to empty the bag. That's what we call repentance. Be careful you don't arrive in the mission field with a bag of rocks on your shoulders. Take care of those matters before you leave. Now, some missionaries who do have to come home under these circumstances are eligible to return. And that's by recommendation of their bishop and their stake presence. We have many marvelous, wonderful experiences like that. In many cases, they return to the same mission, unless it's an overseas assignment. Missionaries are not returned overseas the second time under that circumstance. Number three, and this is most interesting, how can girlfriends be more help and support to their missionary boyfriends rather than be a hindrance? Be specific. I'd like to meet the sister who wrote that. Well, I think of the story of a missionary who entered the field, and contrary to the mission president's instruction and contrary to mission rules, he wrote his girlfriend every day a long letter to his girlfriend. Mission president counseled him against it. He continued to do it. He counseled again. He continued to do it. One day he got a letter. He opened it up and read it. And yes, it was that Dear John letter. It went something like this: Dear so-and-so, I would like you to know that I'm going to marry the mailman. So be careful. I think, sisters, the best thing you can do is to expect and give encouragement to and let it be known that in your life, as a companion, that young man should be a return missionary. If the expectation is there, if the encouragement is there, then that's a great motivation. Elder Haight many years ago gave a talk in conference that said that our sisters become the guardians of the morality of young men. And I think there's great truth in that. So give encouragement, give strength. And I would say, while a special friend is out on a mission, that improve yourself. Take classes such as you're doing here. Improve your learning of the gospel, because your friend in the mission field is learning the gospel very, very, very quickly. Now, we have a saying that goes like this. We tell missionary elders, your girlfriend won't wait for you, but your wife will. Now, you think about that. The Lord has a way of knowing what's right in all cases. So don't be too worried about that part of waiting. But what you do is motivate, encourage, strengthen, and make sure that your letters are the type of letters that build testimony rather than detract from the experience one is having in the mission field. Now, this one. What is the counsel so far as new converts serving missions? My 24-year-old boyfriend has been a member for a year now. Should he serve a mission? Is it his duty? Does he have the same responsibility as the lifelong members? Answer is yes. If you understand the doctrines of the church and the scriptures, the doctrine is that we have an obligation to share the gospel to all the world. Every person alive is entitled to hear from the mouth of a missionary the message of the restored gospel. Sister Tingey and I have just returned from one of the most populous countries of the world, in the Hong Kong, Thailand, Cambodia, Philippines, Singapore area, where President Bateman presided at one time as member of the area presidency. Billions of people. They are entitled to hear someone bear witness that Jesus is the Christ, the gospel has been restored through a prophet today, and there's a prophet alive today. That will take the efforts of every young man in the church. And I would say that we have in many, many missions, when you get overseas, in many cases, maybe half of the missionaries are converts to the church. The age for young men is 19 through 25. When I served in Australia, I would say a third of our missionaries were converts 22, 23, 24 years of age. So that injunction applies to all of you, even though you might be a convert to the church. Question, do I need a testimony to go on a mission? I'm not sure that's a real question. I read that and my heart wept if that was a question. And I thought to myself, what have we done to you if you would have to ask a question like that? Do I need a testimony to serve a mission? Did you notice what Brother and Sister Groupman did as they prepared to play for you? The lovely sister on the piano, she touched several of the notes. And then they tuned their violin to the notes, using as a mechanism for the tuning their ear. That's why they are professional, because they have the ability to have that fine tuning take place. To be in tune is to have the Spirit. The first scripture a missionary learns in the MTC is in the 42nd chapter of the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 14. It reads, "If ye have not the Spirit, ye shall not teach." When a missionary is attempting to teach someone, there's one person here, one person here, and you're speaking with your mouth, they are hearing with their ears. So there's some communication going from mouth to ear, but that does not result in conversion. Conversion takes place when there is a transmittal from heart to heart, and that only takes place by the Spirit. So yes, a testimony is essential. You cannot do missionary work without a testimony. Now, the question might be, do I have a testimony? That might have been the real question. My wife commented on that, and her suggestion was, most of you have stronger testimonies than you think. You might be trying to find empirical evidence to prove it. Just have faith and do good service, and you'll find you have a testimony. But that's what I said. In preparation for a mission, the most important thing you do is to build and establish your testimony. Now, the question is about how soon does one go to the temple before entering the MTC? Is it recommended to be close within a month and so forth? That's usually handled by your local priesthood leaders, but generally you would not go to the temple much too soon before you enter the MTC, usually after you've had your mission call and you're beginning to make your preparations. That's when that would be appropriate. And your local priesthood leaders can help you with that. And there's reasons and fine counsel why that would be the case. That generally is not a problem we experience, but it's something to look forward to. And let me say, the best preparation to go on a mission is not necessarily to be worthy to be a missionary, but to be worthy to go to the temple. If one is worthy to go to the temple, you are also worthy to be a missionary. And so, as you sit down with your priesthood leaders and they review with you the requirements for entering the temple, then you can gauge how close you are to preparation for a mission. I'm the type of person who follows my heart. I've had a frustrating time discerning between the Spirit and my heart. How can I truly know that it is the Spirit telling me things and not my own desires? Well, everybody has that challenge. Everybody is trying to determine How do you know? The best series of scriptures, if you turn to the Doctrine and Covenants, I think it's in chapter 6, chapter 8, chapter 9, right in there, you have the instruction to the prophet Joseph Smith, where he was being taught how to discern the Spirit as he was beginning the translation. On one of the verses that speaks that the Spirit is the communication to the heart and the mind. And then it makes reference that this is the form of communication that came to Moses when he led the children of Israel across the Red Sea. Now, we would tend to think that Moses had fire at night and clouds in the day, and he just kind of followed it, and there was some of that, we know. But it's interesting that much of what Moses felt was impressions to the mind and the heart. And I think if you understand that, there won't be a different impression to the heart and the different impression to the mind. They are one. The heart will generally feel it more intensely. One of the ways that we don't know if we have a testimony or the Spirit is that we have never exercised it by performing good service. If you're not sure you have a testimony, go out and do service to others. Help. Be a contributor. And that will help you understand, yes, I do have the Spirit. I do feel something. And be a contributor more than a participant. What places in the world are not open to missionary work? I think I mentioned that. Basically, the Islamic countries, these are the countries that surround the Mediterranean Sea, Northern Africa, and those parts of the world, although we have some units there where mostly people who live there in business, who are not local people, but we don't have missionaries there, and then generally mainland China. And the question is often asked, well, when will that change? The answer that I give is, I don't know. Got enough to do right now. But in the Lord's own due time, all we need to do is be prepared for when that time comes. Many of you would remember, many of you wouldn't. It's been in your short life that most of us could not have envisioned that we would have missionaries in the Eastern Bloc country that we now have. We have 7 missions in Russia alone. We have missions in all those countries that when we were younger, they were so far away that we couldn't envision. And this wonderful couple that has played for us, they've lived in that environment. But in the Lord's time, He has allowed that to happen. We must be prepared as a people that when that time comes, we as a people will do that. And we will need missionaries. We employ 59,000 missionaries. And every mission president writes me and said, I want more missionaries. What would happen if we could open up another 25 missions somewhere in the world? Where would they come from? They come from you. They come from all over the church. And so let's not worry about countries not open. Let's be prepared to enter when that time comes. Many of my female friends used to want to go on a mission, but now because of what President Hinckley said, they think they shouldn't go. Well, I do not think this is what President Hinckley's intent was. Will anyone say anything that will help to counteract this misunderstanding? Many of my friends seem to have misunderstood what he said. Or maybe I'm the only one who doesn't understand. There's actually 3 questions on that subject. I'm a sister. I'm planning to go on a mission. I turn 21 in 3 months, and she speaks of that. There's one other. Talking about sisters. Will the age for sisters be lowered? Let me address that issue for just a few minutes, and let me say how I talk about it. I do not try to interpret what President Hinckley said. I carry with me what he said. So I'm going to read to you what he said without any interpretation. And I think if you have the Spirit, then you will understand. He begins by acknowledging that he has 2 granddaughters on missions. They are bright and beautiful young women. They are working hard and accomplishing much good. Speaking with their bishops and their parents, they made their own decisions to go. They did not tell me until they turned in their papers. I had nothing to do with their decision to go. Now, having made that confession, I wish to say that the First Presidency and the Council of the Twelve are united in saying to our young sisters that they are not under obligation to go on a mission. I hope I can say what I have to say in a way that will not be offensive to anyone. Young women should not feel that they have a duty comparable to that of young men. Some of them will very much wish to go. If so, they should counsel with their bishop as well as their parents. If the idea persists, the bishop will know what to do. I say what has been said before, that missionary work is essentially a priesthood responsibility. As such, our young men must carry the major burden. This is their responsibility and their obligation. We do not ask the young women to consider a mission as an essential part of their life's program. Over a period of many years, we have held the age level higher for them in an effort to keep the number going relatively small. Again, to the sisters, I say that you will be as highly respected. You will be considered as being as much in the line of duty. Your efforts will be as acceptable to the Lord and to the church, whether you go on a mission or do not go on a mission. We constantly receive letters from young women asking why the age for sister missionaries is not the same as for elders. We simply give them the reasons. We know that they are disappointed. We know that many have set their hearts on missions. We know that many of them wish this experience before they marry and go forward with their adult lives. I certainly do not wish to say or imply that their services are not wanted. I simply say that a mission is not necessarily a part of their life. Now, what may appear to be something of a strange thing, or then he says why he said it in sacrament meeting. Well, that's a statement of the prophet. Read the May ensign, and you can reread it again, and I think the Lord will help you understand and interpret what President Hinckley meant by that. What sins do I need to confess to the bishop before going on a mission? You don't really want me to talk about that here. What you need to do is to talk to your bishop and stake present. And if you have that kind of question, that means that the Spirit is prompting you to get clarification. I was very pleased when I received the November ensign. I would counsel you, if you have a question like that, you might refer to some of the talks that came out from General Conference last October. Two in particular, which I would suggest, would be the talk of Elder Richard G. Scott and the talk of Elder Jeffrey R. Holland. They both address this issue of things that can deter one from going to a temple or going on a mission. I think if you read those two talks, that you will have the answer in your mind, and you will know very certain what you might need to change in your life if this is a challenge you personally have, so that you could prepare to go on a mission. Question is, how are assignments made for missionaries? This question was asked in the earlier meeting we had upstairs, and I'd like to share this with you because it is very critical for you to understand that. When your papers arrive in the missionary department, following the screening of the medical side, we have to be certain that we know everything that's important about you medically, because missionary work is hard, and we've got to make sure that physically and emotionally you can do it. Once that's been cleared, then all of the information on those recommends are loaded into one of our computers. And then each week, members of the 12, it does not involve the 70, it does not involve the staff, but only the 12, they will come over and they will sit down in a room, and in a large television screen, a computer operator will bring up the information on your recommend, and they can see it. They'll see your picture. They can read who you are, where you lived, the names of your parents, how well you did in school. That's all on the recommend. It'll talk about the comments of your stake president and your bishop, and all of the essential information is there. And then they will look at the screen, and it'll indicate, this is what we need. We need so many Portuguese. We need so many Cantonese, so many German, so many Italian-speaking missionaries in these missions. And then with the spirit of inspiration, they will make the assignment. And it'll be logged in. They'll move to the next person. The computer operator says nothing. He only moves the screen along. And then the papers are prepared, and the First Presidency can review them. Many times they might initially make a determination, then the call letter will come from the prophet. It's an inspired call that comes from those whom we sustain as prophet, seers, and revelators. Any reassignment of a missionary is done in exactly the same way. As a mission president, I remember years ago, we were beginning to teach Spanish-speaking people in Sydney, Australia. This was in 1973, before many of you were born. We did not have any language-speaking missionaries there. We had thousands of migrants who had moved from South America into Sydney, part of a refugee situation that was existing there. We had a few members who were bilingual, and the missionaries would use these bilingual members, mostly sisters, and they would teach in English, and it would be translated into Spanish, and we had many baptisms. I wish to have some missionaries come from the MTC trained in Spanish, but I was told to see if I could develop a little bigger program before they committed them, because that's quite a challenge to send language missionaries into an English-speaking environment. So I had three missionaries there, and I thought, well, if I can get one more, I've got two companionships. I had a new group of missionaries arrive one day, and as I interviewed them when they arrived, as I sat down with this one elder, he was handsome, he was tall, he was very blonde, he was from Salt Lake, as I remember. He had a Scandinavian name. And as I interviewed him, I just had an incredible impression that he was a missionary that I needed to learn Spanish and teach in Spanish. I excused him. I went and read his papers. There was nothing. He hadn't had any Spanish in school. But I had the impression, so I brought him back in, and I said, Elder, I'm going to call you to labor in a Spanish-speaking area in Sydney, and I'd like you to learn Spanish. Now, if you've seen any white knuckles, you should have seen him. I think I had an English-Spanish dictionary. I said, your companion doesn't know too much Spanish, but he's been working on it, and I'd like you to go out and serve with him. Well, he accepted the call. A couple of weeks later, he called me. He said, President Tingey, I've got to come talk to you. I thought to myself, he's going to go home. I've ruined him. He came into the office, and he said, President Tingey, I need to share with you. When I was a teenager and received my patriarchal blessing, Patriarch said that if I prepared and was worthy, I would be called as a missionary and I would serve in a foreign country and I would speak a foreign tongue. He said, when I had my call to Australia, I knew it was English speaking and I worried about my call. And then the first day I arrived here 2 weeks ago, you assigned me to learn Spanish. He said, I know I'm in the right mission. Well, he learned Spanish. And he and those other three missionaries became the senior companions of the first group of Spanish-trained elders from the MTC. Years later, I was in Australia, and I met in a conference of 300 to 400 Spanish-speaking people. I said, how many of you joined the church during this time? And I indicated the time when this elder and his companions were teaching. About a third of the audience stood up. The Lord knows where you're to go. He knows what your assignment will be. I can give you that assurance. Never question about where you are called to serve. Now, in conclusion, should I serve a mission? Many of you might have, well, probably you didn't, but if you might have remembered my talk at conference in April, priesthood session. I spoke on missionary service, and my father had just passed away before that, and so that event was on my mind. And I shared these statistics with you that might be of help to you. My father died at the age of 88, He had 10 children. I was the oldest of the 10. I have 8 living brothers and sisters, one having passed away many years ago. And so all 8 of us have been married. There's been many children and grandchildren. I have one of my nephews right here today. And when he died, he left his 9 children and their spouses, 56 grandchildren, 116 great-grandchildren, a total of 228 people were in my father's family. Now, here's the point of my story. When my father was 20 years of age, it was in the middle of the Depression, 1929. He was called as a missionary. There was no money. I don't know how my grandfather supported him, but he went out to Australia to serve. He served a wonderful, honorable mission. When he returned home, he met my mother. They got married and they had their family. As I grew up in a small home that my mother still lives in, 3 bedrooms, 10 children, 1 bathroom. We didn't know we were deprived of anything. We thought everybody had a home that big. But growing up in that home, the thing I remember, my father would keep in the living room on a little coffee table the picture albums of his mission. They were leather. And I remember turning the pages and picture of him on a ship, picture of him in Fiji as they stopped there en route to Australia, pictures of him in long black tails and stove hats with missionaries in the field. And he always talked about his mission. He was proud to have been a missionary, and he was very successful. Many people joined the church under his labors. And he taught us to be missionaries. And as I looked at his family when he passed on, of that large family, 47 of that family, including children, grandchildren, and spouses who had married into the family, had served missions, representing almost 100 years of missionary service because one man served a mission. Now, if you want to get started right in your life, then prepare yourself to serve a mission, and it will be the basis for every righteous decision you will make throughout your life. I can look back on my mission. I had a wonderful mission. I seemed like I loved every day of it. I'm not saying I didn't have discouragement and challenges. Every missionary does. But I had some marvelous experiences. But every decision I have made since that time, in terms of my schooling, my profession, the work I did to make a living for my family, to some extent where we moved and lived, and even my church callings have reflected the basis of a mission. The environment of the mission gave me the ability, I think, to make the best choices I could that have helped me to be happy, to be married to a woman I love, to have wonderful children, and to have all of that which I now enjoy. And I can't possibly imagine myself trying to make these decisions today that I have to make without the mission as the basis. And I just leave with you my witness and my testimony that the best thing you can do for you, the best thing you can do for the parents of your children, is to serve a mission, to be worthy, to be clean, to feel of the Spirit, to learn the gospel, to come home with direction, to know what life has in store for you, and to have an ability to communicate with your Father in heaven in a way that all the decisions you'll make the rest of your life will be right because you can communicate through the Spirit. Now, young people, I leave with you my witness and my testimony. And this is one of the challenges and the charge that President Bateman and I share as members of the 70. Our calling is to bear witness of Jesus Christ in all the world, wherever we are sent, for as long as we are sent. I bear you my witness that Jesus is the Christ. This is his church. It's named after him, the doctrines he has established. He is the Redeemer. He has wrought the atonement. He has provided for us the opportunity. We have an obligation to share that message with all the world. As Elder Irene said at conference, the day will come when somebody on the other side will say to you, "Why didn't you tell me what you knew when you knew me there?" We have that obligation to share that message today with every person of the world. They're entitled to hear it from your ears. I bear witness that Joseph Smith was a prophet. He saw the Father and the Son in the sacred grove. He received the plates from the angel Moroni. He translated this marvelous book, the Book of Mormon, in which is another witness of Jesus Christ. I bear witness that it's all true. I was with President Hinckley not too long ago. We were talking about the sacred grove, and he just simply said, "It happened. It happened. I believe it happened." And he shared a wonderful, loving testimony of his feelings about the prophet Joseph Smith. I bear witness in conclusion that President Hinckley is a prophet. You only have to associate with him as we do, and Elder Bateman has many opportunities, and see the wisdom, the mantle that that man holds. He is a prophet of God. I believe he receives all the inspiration and revelation that we need to govern our lives and to govern this church. I leave this witness with you. Pray for your happiness, your success, and your well-being in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.